Good deal. Well, my name is Justin Bader with the Principal Center, and I want to introduce my co-presenter and co-author, Heather Bell Williams, who is a principal in New Brunswick in Eastern Canada. And we're very excited to share with you some work that we have been developing for the last couple of years and are putting into book form right now. And we'd love to both share with you our latest thinking and get your feedback on how you might develop clearer shared expectations for particular areas of instructional practice. So I'll let Heather introduce herself here and take it away. My work is at the Principal Center, where I focus on instructional leadership and have been able to partner with SIDME in the past on various events and have a chance to talk about instructional leadership. You know, any chance I get, I'm very excited to dive into this work. So thanks so much for being here. Heather, you wanna say a little bit about yourself and take it away? And I'll sure. advance the slides, yeah.
Thanks, Justin. As Justin said, my name is Heather Bell Williams. I'm a principal in K-5 elementary school in New Brunswick, Canada. And it's been my privilege to work with Justin now for, I think, around 4 or 5 years. I started out as a Principal Center member, and we started to have conversations around the work of the Principal Center and around my work as it related to my elementary school principalship. And those conversations just led to more conversations, and now we're working on the book together. So it's super exciting, and we're thrilled to be able to share this. Like Justin said, this is kind of the first run through for us. We're sharing it with you before it comes out in the book, and so we'd love to hear your input as we go along. So we basically have three goals for our time together today. We want to provide an overview of some of those key ideas of improvement frameworks. Like Justin mentioned, we also want to provide some examples of how you might use the improvement maps or improvement frameworks, and to identify some existing sources of shared expectations. Those shared expectations are funny things. We think we know, and we think we agree and are sharing our expectations with our staff. And we, through experience, I've learned very much that it's not necessarily shared, that what I think my expectations are for someone, even if it's written down, they don't share the same set of common language around those expectations. We also are hoping to identify areas where you can use improvement frameworks or instructional frameworks, and where more specificity might help you and might help you coach your teachers to grow and to improve. How we got here is, I use the illustration of a puzzle. And how we got here was Justin in his first book, Now We're Talking, discussed a lot around habits and how to form habits in your office and in your work to free up time that would allow you to get to classrooms and to do those observations. In our district, we call them walkthroughs. You might call them classroom observations. You might call them walkthroughs or something else. Some people call them rounds. But basically that idea of doing classroom visits to the tune of 500 or more classroom visits / observations a year. And then the conversations come after that. We've been talking, Justin and I, about the idea of, well, what are we talking about when we get to the conversation part? I found it a little easier to get the habits and the time under control, and then it was time to have those conversations. And that's where it came to light that those shared expectations that I thought I had for my staff weren't exactly so. We often use a map to depict the idea of a journey, the idea that we're taking our staff and our whether it's teachers or support staff, from one place where they are right now to another place. And if you think back to the origins of the word coach, it's really that old-fashioned stagecoach idea where you are coaching, you are moving your staff from where they are now to another place. And we see these instructional frameworks as a tool to be able to move our staff from where they are and to where we want them to be, to grow and to improve. We have lots of ways of articulating shared expectations now. We have, in our district at least, there are walkthrough forms, there are checklists, there are all different ways. We're famous in our district for look for documents. We would have dozens of look for documents. Things that in a perfect world, instructional leaders would use. They would go into classrooms, they would check things off, and they would then be helping teachers, in theory, to improve. The problem is that I found that when I was doing checklists or walkthrough forms, if a teacher was already doing really well, all I did was check off all the things on the list and walked out. It really didn't do that teacher who was already performing well or me any good. It didn't help he or she grow. It didn't give me any information around what was really going on in the classroom or how I might lead the school to higher levels of improvement. The other thing that it did or didn't do was when a staff was struggling, again, a checklist and a walkthrough form did nothing or does nothing to help me help that person to improve. If it's a checklist, something's there or something isn't there, the staff probably already knows what is or isn't there. And so it doesn't help. Those kinds of checklists and short walkthrough forms don't help struggling staff improve, and they don't help me help them improve. So really what we decided we needed to do was to find a way to capture that insider's view of the teaching world. So Justin has used in the past in some of his other writing and work this analogy of an iceberg. And it's that idea that so much of what we can see is just the tip of the iceberg. Most of what we see when we walk through a classroom and check off our checklists or our look for documents is only about 10% of what's really, really going on. And that beneath the surface, that other big 90% chunk is underneath the surface of the water. And it's never anything that we're going to be able to see or hear when we walk through a classroom. Things like decision making, things like professional judgment, things like the planning that went into this particular piece of instruction, things like what happened yesterday and what is the teacher thinking is going to happen tomorrow, and in the moment judgments, when we see a teacher move and help a certain student or handle a particular behavior management piece in a certain way, we have no idea around the thinking, the past history, and what's going to happen next. So
can I say a little bit on that, Heather?
You sure can.
Sorry to interrupt. You're on a,
no, you
a
go
great
right
roll
ahead.
Here. But I have to say, for me, a lot of this came from the fear that maybe my surface level feedback was not really respecting the complexity of the work that teachers were doing, all right? That I might have some look-fors. As you said, you know, many different districts have look-for documents. We had look-for documents. We had high leverage moves. And I felt like by participating in this instructional leadership effort to give feedback on the high leverage moves and, you know, reinforce the look-fors, that sometimes I was actually making teaching worse. And I don't know if you've ever had that feeling, and you know, hopefully we all strive to do the best we can with the expectations that we're trying to reinforce. But sometimes I felt like teachers were actually beyond those kind of simplistic look-fors. And by emphasizing something that was, you know, kind of low level, kind of straightforward, that the teacher was kind of beyond, that I might actually be holding them back. And I became a principal at a pretty young age. I moved from a middle school science teaching position to a elementary kind of dean of students position to an elementary principalship. So a lot of the pedagogy of especially the younger grades was new to me. And it seemed like there was a lot going on there. You know, even though, you know, we think, you know, younger grades, the standards are simpler, the directions are simpler and so forth. Like I knew there were depths there that I didn't want to miss out on. And yet people would kind of go along with me if I just said, okay, do these big, simple things, and I want to see it and I want to write it down. I feel like it's normal for people to accept that. But I want to challenge that idea that teaching is simple, that it's just what you see, you can just kind of write it down or check it off on a list, and people should just do more of those simplistic, visible things in order to improve. So we're really looking deeper here and trying to see different dimensions of practice than just what's observable. So sorry to interrupt there, Heather, just wanted to run with that a bit.
We're hoping for a back and forth, and because we're not in the same room, that's what we're going to need to do. You know, what Justin said about the teachers that are already doing good work, that was where I was frustrated as well. How was I helping them get even better? a firm believer that everybody, we can all go from good to great and even greater. We all need to be improving. And it was impossible with the tools that I had to help them get better and to coach them and to help them improve. And so we've coined the term instructional frameworks, and we're proposing that the key differences between instructional frameworks and some of those checklist walkthrough ideas are that these are based on key elements of decision making, not what we see. So this is around areas of professional judgment. It's also a shared language that isn't so detailed as a script. It's not a teacher's guide where what you say is in bold print and everything else, what you do, is in brackets. It's not that kind of script, but it's also detailed enough to lead to improved professional judgment and decision making. So what we've done for you is we have an example of a checklist for a guided math, a piece of pedagogy that we would use in our school a fair bit. And so if I was using a checklist for guided math, it might be something like small group lessons, large group lessons, warm-ups, math conferences, and formative assessment. But it doesn't matter how many times I go into a classroom or how short or long my visitations are, if I take that checklist and give that kind of thing back to a teacher, whether the teacher's doing a fantastic bang-up job or not doing well at all, nothing's going to change. There's nothing that we can do from just that checklist alone. And so the next slide shows an instructional framework for guided math. And that idea of what we've done, and this would take a long time if you were doing this in your school, but we would be looking at identifying an area where you feel practice could improve. And that could ideally come from having done a lot of walkthroughs and a lot of observations. This was the case in my particular school. I was doing a lot of observations and walkthroughs. And in conversation, I realized that our K-5 team in its entirety were looking for ways to differentiate math and also to look for some improvements in math achievement. And so what I have constructed here is an improvement framework or instructional framework for guided math. And the idea is that down the left-hand side, I've brainstormed the key components, and they could be anything for the purposes of this particular framework. I said lessons, differentiation, the format, and the assessment. So I've taken this sort of buzzword of guided math that I could say to my staff, hey, we're all going to be doing guided math. And we've broken it down into key components. For our purposes, we're using four levels. And you can see from left to right, level one is really just that buzzword. The teacher teaches large group lessons. In this case, the teacher might know what guided math is. They may not know what guided math is. And then level two, level three, level four. Level four is not a necessity. Level three is the goal. And if a teacher chooses to be at level three, I, as the instructional leader, need to accept that and honor that. But level four would be that above and beyond. And we're not going to be looking for all of our staff to be in level four in everything that we do. So each component is depicted in the four levels. And again, going from novice to above and beyond. So just to recap, we've done our classroom observations. We've got into those classrooms. We've had conversations with staff. And now we're identifying a practice, a particular practice that we believe it would be valuable to have some shared language and shared expectations around. We've taken a look at a guided math in this case. We've got our key components and our levels of performance. So as you think about your work in your school, we wonder if you can be thinking about now practices where we need or you need common language. Each school has pieces of practice that need that common language that you could divide, break down into an instructional framework. When Justin first pitched this idea to me, I didn't really understand it. And Justin, you can jump in here. We were talking at that time about I think I was working in one of your courses and we were talking about this idea of me creating a framework. And it wasn't until we started to brainstorm together some of those things where we needed common language. Each school had pieces of practice, you said, that are unique and where common language would be beneficial, where there wasn't already common language. So we'd invite you in the chat, if you could, to put some ideas in there about some practices in your school where you think it might be beneficial to develop this kind of instructional framework. Yeah. So do you want to take a look at the chat and see what's there?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm hearing about the class assessment model for early childhood education. I want to put this format back up on the screen. And I want to ask, maybe you can answer this in the chat too, what does this look like to you? I don't think we've mentioned the elephant in the room that that this kind of resembles, but it's definitely based on something that is familiar to many of us, both in the United States and Canada. Anybody recognize this particular format? Because there's a design here that's, you know, obviously not new, that's been in our profession for many years. I think the origin of this particular design for shared expectations goes back to about 1996. Is that when you encountered the first edition of this, Heather? Does that sound about right?
About right, yeah. I'd have to check, but it's the mid-1990s.
Yeah, Sue's got it, the Danielson framework, right? So the Danielson framework is used in numerous districts across the United States and Canada and around the world. And of course, it's a teacher evaluation framework. So what we're proposing to do is say, okay, if that specificity in the Danielson framework is helpful for conducting better evaluations and helping people grow overall, couldn't we use that same idea to improve in specific practices? Because all too often, we think of a specific practice and then we just list it very simplistically, right? Like small group lessons. Okay, well, like how? What makes a good small group lesson? Because we could do something on a simplistic and straightforward list in a good way, in a mediocre way, in a bad way, and the quality matters, right? So what we're pressing ourselves to do here and what we're inviting you to try to do is articulate what you're looking for, not necessarily just in the most obvious and observable ways, like with look fors, but really what it's like, as Heather said, for decision making, for the person who is exercising the professional judgment. And a big part of the challenge here, Sue's mentioning that working with Danielson
I love that.
Can be so cumbersome, because like the problem with Danielson is it doesn't fit on a slide, right? It's like 24 different components, it's like 13 pages long, you know, depending on how you print it, it's an extremely long document. So the way to make this workable is to zoom way in and to say, we're not going to consider all of teaching kindergarten through 12th grade and every single subject area as Danielson does, which is, you know, it's useful for that purpose. If we're going to focus on particular practices, we've got to zoom way in, like primary guided math, right? And Heather, was this a first grade example? Is that right?
This was a K-2 example K-2. In particular. We had a different framework for our 3-5s, but this was K-2.
Yeah. So thinking about, as Heather said, your school and the improvement focuses that you have and the different challenges that teachers are facing, what do you see as some areas where getting more specific about shared expectations would be helpful? Developing some common language would be helpful. And don't obligate yourself to think in terms of things that are relevant to everyone, because again, that's part of what makes Danielson so overwhelming, is that it has to apply to everyone. Where do you see an opportunity for improvement in your school? Peggy, great to see you here. Peggy says SEL, social and emotional learning. Mm-hmm. Heather, I think that's a great one. Can we talk about SEL for a second?
Sure can, because that was one of the ones that that we developed in our school most recently, actually, because of the pandemic and because of the increased focus on student and staff mental health and resiliency and the staff working through social emotional learning as a almost separate area this year. And we realized it would be integrated in a perfect world, but really taking a look at implementing social emotional learning. We had that idea of implementing SEL on our school improvement plan for several years previous. And we ran into this idea of, well, how do we know if we're implementing social emotional learning? We weren't at a place where we had sort of reliable baseline data. We had just been dabbling in it. And so this idea of coming up with an instructional framework for teachers around what does it look like to be a novice or level one, a beginner at social emotional learning instruction. And that's okay, by the way, because everybody starts somewhere, and we had lots of new teachers, people who had never really addressed we were using zones of regulation as a program. So we did do an instructional framework around just that. And then we've extended it a little bit to include some of the adult practices. We did a framework this past school year. It's not an instructional practice, but it was adults' social emotional well-being and how to support their growth in that area too.
And that's one where we talk about this a little bit in the book, the idea that like sometimes at the very beginning of an initiative, it's better to be vague because you can get people to agree that social emotional learning is a good thing. It's like apple pie, right? Like nobody would say, actually, I don't think we should at all consider social emotional learning. That sounds like a bad idea, right? Like when we're vague and we have that kind of big picture vision, it's easier for people to say yes to it. And long term, though, the consequence of that is, though, that we agree to a lot of things, and yet we don't really know if we're all talking about the same thing, right? If we keep it at that level of social emotional learning, this is the level that we call a buzzword, right? Nobody has a problem with it, sounds great, but are we even talking about the same thing? We could have 32 classrooms and have 32 definitions of what SEL is. So we can get more specific, we can come up with a definition, but ultimately where we want to end up is with a framework that looks like this, that says, these are the key components. We've listed them in the first column there. So components of SEL, I don't think we've made a framework for SEL, but you have one for the implementation of your specific curriculum, right, Heather? That was how you chose to approach that?
Yeah.
And then we say, what does that look like at different levels of proficiency? So rather than just say, everybody's doing SEL, sounds good, right? And just hope that we end up with something similar in every classroom, we get very, very detailed and specific about it. And Heather, do you want to talk just briefly about where you get some of those specifics? Because obviously the curriculum itself contains some of them, but you've found different ways, and these are showing up in the book as well, to identify what goes in that framework. Because we don't always know in advance what should go in every spot in the table there.
Absolutely, and that's the next key thing for you to think about, is where you might find some language to get started. I will tell you that if it's a instructional practice that I'm familiar with, I would have a lot more in my head to come up with. I have a good sense of what it should look like. I've done a lot of work around primary literacy and math, and so I do have those ideas in my mind and can construct pieces of the framework pretty easily. Things that are really specific, like using zones of regulation for your social emotional learning program, K-5, we would turn to the actual curriculum. We are moving away from zones and we're going to paths next year. And so we would be looking at the actual similar frameworks and rubrics in paths around that implementation. We would still be talking to our teachers, not about what it looks like, but what it's like. What is it like to be at a level 3 in implementing zones or paths or guided math, or just in one of your examples, I think, is rigor. Am I right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, rigor. And Sean is mentioning equity, another one where, yeah, people are going to agree to equity, but what does that mean? What does that mean for practice? What does that mean for the decisions that people make on a day-to-day basis? Not just, and we're gonna keep saying this, not just what does it look like? Because we ask ourselves that question by default as instructional leaders, and we're suggesting that that's actually not the best question to ask. Not what does it look like, but what is it like for somebody who's doing that work?
Angie also says data literacy. And as you mentioned, Sean mentioned equity in our system. Inclusion would be a big buzzword. And we think we know what it means to be data literate, or to be what it is to be equitable. When new staff come into our buildings, we sort of assume, and I guess we get lucky because we think, okay, that turned out okay. We assume they knew what we meant when we said, let's do this or do guided math or social emotional learning. But we find that, or we're asserting that that idea of real growth and improvement is only going to happen when we get specific and nail down these shared expectations. One of the things that was really important to me in our conversations with my conversations with Justin was this idea of how do I help staff move? And I've been all around the mulberry bush. I wanted to get super specific and have, well, what questions would I ask to get them to go from level one to level two? And I've loved the conversations that we've had because it boils down to, it has to be general enough at supporting staff and moving from level one to level two in math in grade two is generally the same idea as supporting staff as they move from level one to level two in grade 12 chemistry. And so we have come up with this idea of how to support staff as they call it level up, as they move. And not all staff may be at that level one, at that beginning level. They may be starting at a level two. They may be starting at a level three. But the idea of supporting them as they level up is unpacked on this slide. So in level one, as we said, it's that buzzword. It's we're doing rigor. We're doing guided math. We're doing equity. And in level one, directive feedback is required. Your role is that of the boss in this case. And it's, yep, we're doing it, but this is how we're doing it. We're going to move up to level two. And once they get to level two, your feedback is going to be a little less directive as you move them into level three. That level one to level two, super directive. Your role is the boss. This is what needs to be included. These are the key components of rigor. These are the key components of equity as we explore that in this building. Then as they're at level two, feedback's a little less directive when you're trying to move them from level two to level three. This would be the biggest opportunity for improvement. Level one and to level two is usually a pretty quick decision, and we want staff to move from that novice level of just knowing the buzzword to get to level two. This is where from level two to level three, where there's the biggest opportunity for improvement. You're looking for, we've used an acronym TIP, we're looking for people to work around the timeliness of their work, integrated work and proactive work. So if I'm moving from a level two to level three in, say, zones of regulation, I'm not only going to be able to plan a really great zones lesson and use all the language, I'm going to be able to, on the spot, if I'm a level three in terms of timeliness, I'm going to be able to apply a principle that I took, and this is the integration piece, out from last week's lesson and put it into this week's lesson on the spot. So timeliness and integrated, it's not going to just be these isolated lessons. I'm also going to be proactive. You're going to hear me in the hall when I'm chatting with students using the language of zones in a real life situation. And this is the tipping point around professional judgment. This is the tipping point from just the what does it look for and the planning the really specific things into professional judgment. Justin, do you have anything to add there? Am I capturing those key ideas as you go from two to three? That's the meat of it, where there's the most opportunity for growth.
Yeah, especially when we get very specific. And I think when we don't get specific and leave everybody at a level one, we basically just say, do the thing more. Right? Like use the program more, use more of the strategies. And the example that I keep coming back to is the high leverage strategies that we had emphasized in my district. And the way that as instructional leaders, we were trying to get teachers to improve was to get them to use those strategies more frequently. And sometimes that's valuable, right? We don't want to, you know, do things so rarely that they don't have an impact. But often frequency is kind of a crude measure of improvement, right? Like the way that you do something and using a particular strategy in the right circumstance is much more important than just, you know, the raw number of how often you use it. So Principal Center subscribers will have heard me give this example before, but one of the strategies was turn and talk. You have that strategy mm-hmm. in your district, right? Have the students turn and talk. Strategies for accountable talk. It's on lots of lists. It's in lots of books. And it's great to have students talk about what they're learning, right? Well, we emphasized turn and talk so much as a district that teachers caught on that if an administrator showed up or if a team of administrators and their boss all showed up, well, guess what? You'd better do a turn and talk in the first 30 seconds or you were going to get notes about it. You were going to get dinged on your observation form or your walkthrough or your feedback email or whatever you got because the principals wanted to see turn and talks. So we were trying to really pressure teachers to use turn and talks more frequently rather than use them better and more appropriately. I think we've got to be really careful about that because that's where, when we talk about getting into classrooms more often, and Heather mentioned earlier that she started about 4 years ago getting into classrooms 500 times a year. Well, if we're not careful, we can do some real damage by getting into classrooms that much and pressuring teachers to do things just because we want to see them. If they're not appropriate to what needs to happen in the lesson, if they're not appropriate to the teacher's instructional purpose, then we can really throw people off course. And people can say, okay, Justin's here again. Dang it, I guess I gotta do a turn and talk. We were about to do some peer writing, but I guess we're gonna do a turn and talk because Justin's here, dang it. You know, like, I don't wanna be in that situation where I'm taking people away from better judgment and better decision-making. I wanna go back here to the kind of rubric for figuring out whether something is a worthy focus. And Heather, you want to talk about how to pick a good focus, the properties that a worthy focus needs to have?
Sure. You know, things that we would assert you need to consider and things that we've been thinking about as we consider, or as I consider implementing instructional frameworks in my school. So we want it to be a high impact strategy. So you're doing your walkthroughs and you start to see that it might be a good idea for, the primary teachers in my school to work on morning messages, or maybe just in school, he's thinking, okay, there does need to be more rigor in this school. And then maybe in grade 6 and grade 7 or some particular team or group of teachers. So we want it to be high impact. So things like a morning message in primary, things like rigor, things like high expectations for students, things that will have a high impact on student achievement, because that's why we're there. And we want to make sure that it's not some little eccentric piece of practice. And in the same vein, not just a pet peeve of ours. Sometimes we get hooked on a new strategy and your staff might think, oh great, she went to another conference and she learned about this and now we have to do it. We want whatever the practice is. If you're gonna put the time and energy into creating an instructional framework and then ask your staff to work through it, it's gonna be a big time commitment for them and a lot of their brain space is gonna be taken up with this. So it needs to be a high impact practice. It needs to be high frequency. It's not something that if you're just doing something once a month or once every 3 weeks, might not be the best idea. Something that's high frequency, high impact, and where you've seen high variability. If everybody's doing a great job at using rigor or using zones of regulation, or everybody's doing a great job at morning messages, that's not going to be a practice that we're using. We want high variability, where some people are doing it well, but there's others that could grow and improve. The other thing is you don't want it to have to cost you a lot of money, or you have to wait for grant money to come in or wait for resources to be ordered. You need to have the access to the resources in the here and the now. So I invite you in the chat, what do you think of that idea? Think back to what you, the practice that you thought of earlier and that you put in the chat, and think about these four things: high impact, high frequency, high variability, access to resources. Think about whether or not your practice would sort of pass through those filters and work well as the basis for an instructional framework. So I invite you just to put that in the chat.
And if I could ask, could you identify yourself if you're at the secondary level, if you're a middle school or high school person, just type me in the chat. I'm very curious the makeup of our group today. Just type me if you're at the middle or high school level. At the secondary level, it's pretty easy to stay busy with worthy focuses that don't even require you to get into one specific subject area. You know, if you wanted to just focus on, you know, management routines and class culture and equity and things that do cut across subject areas as a secondary leader, you absolutely could, you know, could stay busy and not run out of things to focus on, even without getting into a particular subject area. However, you may want to choose something that is within a particular department or a particular team. If you see on the third point here about high variability, you have one of those departments that has like one rock star or two rock stars, and then someone else who's just not at the same level, right? And it's kind of obvious to you. It may be obvious to other people. Where there's high variability within a team, that can be a great opportunity to help people learn from one another. But often, if you just have people observe each other, again, they're looking at those surface things. So if you have a kind of struggling teacher observe a very, very strong teacher, they're not really going to get the thinking and the decision making that are happening behind the scenes that make that excellent teacher an excellent teacher, unless you can kind of unpack the thinking that's going on beneath the surface. Because it's not just administrators and instructional coaches who see what's on the surface, it's also peers, right? It's very easy for peers to miss what's making my colleague down the hall such an extraordinary teacher. How can I learn from them? Well, often we need to break it down. We need to dive in and kind of map it out so people can see the differences in not just the visible aspects of practice, but the deeper aspects. So let us know in the chat, what is an area that you are thinking about? And we can kind of workshop these a little bit. Don't worry about wrong answers or we won't be critical of ideas, but we will help you kind of unpack them and maybe zoom in on a focus where you might want to. There we go. Sean's got one. Small group instruction and having kids work in groups. Maybe the teacher rotates around to different groups. Yeah. Heather, you want to say anything on that one? And Sean, let us know if you want to say something about that one. Not an obligation, but if you want to say more about small group instruction, we'd love to use that as a bit of an example. So feel free to unmute.
Sean, if you're comfortable unmuting, are you elementary or secondary, middle school?
Hi there. Yes, I support teachers K-12. I'm an instructional support coach for the North Carolina New Teacher Support Program. So I just hear small group instruction all the time in literally K through 12. And it looks different when I think about small group instruction. Like, I know that that's high impact. In my classroom as a fourth grade teacher, that did some really big things for my students. You see it all the time. It can happen literally throughout the school day. But then I see that high variability too. Like, I think about teachers have so many different definitions of what that means for them. And what students should be doing in small groups. And so I think that, I don't know, small groups seems like a really great starting place for supporting some of the teachers that I work with.
Yeah,
absolutely. You walked through those sort of, I call them filters, the four filters, and it absolutely fits and filters through all of those things. The next thing for you to consider would be those ideas of the key components. You know, you'd start to think about, okay, so small group instruction, maybe one of the components, depending on the setting, might be who is in the group, you know, group composition. Am I doing this as a tier one kind of thing? Everybody's getting a crack at writing conferencing with the teacher, or am I doing this as a tier two thing because I've done some formative assessment and pulled these kids out because there's something common. So the first thing would be the composition of the groups, perhaps. Justin, some other key components for small group instruction.
I'm thinking about the task, like what's the purpose of dividing kids into a group? Because again, like if I'm the instructional leader who's walking around looking for small groups, you better be doing small groups. How might people do that in an unhelpful way? Like, what pressure might I be putting on people to do something that's not actually good? So there has to be a group worthy task, right? Like a group appropriate task. And of course we could, you know, everybody will come up with, let's see, we get, yeah, learning target, utilization of rubrics, good deal. So there has to be kind of like a purpose. We have to have kids divided in a purposeful way. You know, if it's a group of students who are all struggling with the same concept, then that would be different from, you know, dividing students into a project group where we want the groups to be heterogeneous, but overall similar to each other in terms of the strengths of the students in each group. What else? Sean, you got any ideas about some big key components of effective small group work?
Go ahead, Sean.
Wait, did you say Sean or someone else?
Yeah, Sean, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I'd open it up to anybody, but I always think about data too. Like, so how have we used the data to create those learning tasks? And why are those students in that particular group at that particular time?
Perfect.
I was thinking about what the other kids are doing. So it could be if I'm an intervention teacher and I'm taking a small group to a table, say at the back of the room or the front of the room, or I'm taking a small group of students outside the classroom, the general classroom setting, this wouldn't be an issue. But if I'm the general classroom teacher and I want to work with a small group of four or five students, what the rest of the class is doing is a key component to small group instruction, because I'm not going to get anything done with a small group until I've navigated all of the management pieces around that. So depending on the age of the students and the context, I would put as a key component what the other students are doing.
Yeah. And if anybody has others, there's not like a fixed number of key components.
No.
Usually we end up with like 3 to 5 for a particular practice. But should we talk about levels of performance now, or other thoughts on that, Heather? Okay.
Sure.
Let's talk about levels of performance, because again, if we start with the, like, you know, the simplistic observable expectation, like you should do small groups, we have to think, okay, how are people going to screw that up? Like, how is that going to result in confusion and not ultimately what we want? And probably that's our level one, or maybe even level zero. But level one is where, like, people are kind of doing the right thing. They're trying. We didn't make level one like not doing it at all, or misconduct, or something that would get you fired.
Right.
Like, level one is trying. We're in the ballpark, but it's kind of crude. It's kind of sloppy, and it's not ultimately where we want it to be. So, you know, if I'm a new teacher and I heard that I'm supposed to do small groups, I can at least get to a level one by trying to do small groups. But we can fill in those other levels by thinking, okay, well, what does it look like when it's going really well? What does, and again, see, I'm asking that, you heard me use that word that I said we're not supposed to use. What does it look like? It's not really about what it looks like. We slip into that so easily as observers, as coaches and administrators, but it's not really about what it looks like. It's about what it's like for the person who is running the classroom, for the person who is making the decisions about what do I say to this group? What do I say to that group? How do I use time? All of those decisions that the teacher is making need to be our focus here. If this is going to be a useful document to the teacher, it has to touch on those decisions and not just, you know, what can I see from the back of the room and check off on a list. That's really, really essential here. So let's talk about levels a bit. Heather, you talked about leveling up. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you identified some of what to put in the levels, especially with your, I'm thinking about your instructional aides. What were some of your sources of data for the levels?
So some of the frameworks that you make aren't necessarily always an instructional piece. In my case, and how I really got into this work was the idea of looking for behaviors from staff. I had a situation where I had a large group of instructional assistants or educational assistants, whatever you call them in your district. And I actually had more EAs than I had certified teachers at one point. And I realized that their tool, our shared expectation, our language around their performance was not shared. I realized that when there was a one-page evaluation document that had bulleted points, and it said something like, manages student behavior effectively. My idea of what managing student behavior effectively was like, I almost did it again, and what the EAs thought managing student behavior was like was very different. And we realized very quickly that we needed shared language. And so I embarked on the journey of making several smaller documents into a larger framework. But that idea that level one is just the buzzword. It's just saying something like, I've inherited these expectations from my supervisor that I would manage student behavior, and I know I'm supposed to do it. Level two, there's some more awareness of key ideas. And I think there's a slide that says this, Justin. I don't know where that slide went.
Let's see, the awareness of key ideas. Is it?
Level one's a buzzword. Level two, some awareness of the main ideas. And if you're looking at an instructional practice, you can say, you know, that the teacher can plan for the key ideas. In my case, the EA was able to navigate those key ideas a little bit, but lacked the professional judgment to, I said, to pivot. And so again, level two is probably, I can manage it all when I'm planning and when someone's talking to me outside the moment, but, and I'm reactive. When I get to the classroom and I get to applying whatever this is, a practice as a teacher, an instructional practice, or a behavioral piece around managing other kids' behavior, that kind of thing, I'm still reactive and not able to see how it all fits together. Level three, your staff are getting to awareness of the whole picture of the practice. You're starting to be able to see people exercise that judgment and transfer. You know, in the case of my educational assistants, oh, right, we talked in the last workshop about de-escalation techniques, and I know I can apply this here, even though I learned it to apply to another student. So that timeliness piece can pivot in the moment, integrate all the components coherently, and we get that applied professional judgment. And the teacher or the staff person is trusting their own judgment at this point. They're able to make decisions. They're able to change things up on the fly and know that they've got that good professional judgment.
And I feel like that right there, Heather, the yes or no about that is where you can look at what specific people are doing and say, do they get it or do they not? And if they do get it, well, you can kind of put in your framework just whatever they're doing. And if they don't get it, then maybe there's a key component that they're missing. Or maybe they're just at a level one in one of those key components. And we originally talked about this in terms of the idea of kind of common sense, right? Like if you feel like you have someone who's got common sense, they make good decisions, they transfer information, they apply good professional judgment. And if you have someone who doesn't seem to have a lot of common sense, they're like, maybe they're doing the thing, they're doing the expectation, they're trying, but it's just not working well. And by getting more specific about what's not working well, when someone tries something in kind of a clunky way, they're kind of missing the point, that can help us figure out, okay, what would get them from level one to level two to level three, and ultimately where we want them to be. And we do that by really taking advantage of the variability, right? Like we said, we want to identify practices that are high variability, meaning sometimes people do it really well, and sometimes people do it pretty poorly. That natural variation that already exists within your school is a great source of evidence for what you should put in your framework. You look at what people are doing well, you look at where people are struggling, and basically you organize it. And I think, Heather, you went through a process of organizing, you know, kind of boneheaded mistakes that people would make and great work that people would do. And, you know, you don't want to necessarily put all the boneheaded mistakes in specifically, but you want to kind of describe them in the abstract, in the way that people can understand. So, yeah.
We actually did include examples, but after we got the framework done and the levels in, we added an element that you don't have to add, but we had the staff put the examples in. And so we had staff talk in very generic terms in a workshop setting. What would be an example of a level one, a level two? And so no one had to be outed as, oh yeah, what I did the other day was the level two, but rather the staff came up with sort of fictitious examples or examples from their experience without names, and it became much less personal. And so it allowed staff to place themselves somewhere on that instructional framework and not feel bad about being a novice or a level one or a beginner and moving on up. And I was going to say level three to level four as an administrator is the most fun place to be in terms of encouraging folks to level up, to go from that fully integrated idea and to let them soar into level four. Really, your job is to offer support and offer resourcing and celebrate and really ask them to consider, you know, being the leaders that they are and modeling this for others. And so you don't want to give them lots of work to do because you don't want to make level four a punishment. Like now you get to teach everybody else, but just celebrating the work that people are doing as they have leveled up to that level four and to celebrate. And like I say, resource them and offer them the support. It's lots of fun when you get there. When you know when you're at level four because you're having these great conversations with people and easily resourcing them to continue to soar up and to achieve and to improve in new ways.
Yeah.
Before we finish, we had a few cautions that we wanted to talk through just and very quickly some cautions. Again, we talked about the checklists. Avoid those checklists as much as you can. Scope's important. Don't go too big. When I was doing the framework for our instructional assistants, our EAs, I didn't do the whole thing at once. I started with the behavior management pieces because that's where I was noticing that we needed those shared expectations. So don't go too big, but don't zoom in so tightly that it's just little, again, you're getting into just a little list of what needs to be done, like that scripting. And again, I think Justin mentioned earlier, avoiding that quantitative difference between levels. So number one is rarely, number two is sometimes, number three is usually, number four is always. We want to get rid of those kinds of quantitative things and go qualitative. What is it like to be a two? What is it like to be a three? That's where the tough work of composing the framework comes in. So as we finish up, think about how you could apply this in your school. Perhaps there's a place for some staff growth and improvement on a particular team, perhaps, for some teacher and staff evaluation. Maybe you don't already have a large framework like Danielson, and you could really benefit by zooming in on a particular aspect of your work. Maybe it's to help with your school improvement initiatives, like I had explored before, that idea of implementing something, implementing rigor, implementing equity. Maybe an instructional framework will help you know whether your staff are growing and improving as you share that common language of shared expectations. So there's lots of different ways you can apply it in your school.
And I want to especially highlight the utility of this approach for anyone who's new to their school, right? If you just became the principal of a new school, of course, people will tell you the initiatives that have been underway for various amounts of time. And as you talk with people about those initiatives and the instructional strategies or, you know, just the approaches built into that initiative, you'll gain an understanding of where different people are. And in some cases, the answer to where are people with this initiative is all over the place, right? You talk to 20 different people and you get 20 different answers about what PLCs are or what small group instruction means or what equity means. So as you are figuring out, you know, how do I bring people together around a vision, or how do I get some unity on, you know, what this set of instructional strategies means or how we use this curriculum. I hope that kind of table format that we've shown you over and over, and I'll put one more up on the screen here. I hope this can be kind of an organizing tool for your thinking as you talk with people. Don't feel like it's your goal to make a big document right away, but use this as a tool to just kind of organize your thinking as you pay attention to where people's practice is and how they talk about their own practice. I wanted to just put this up at the end here, and I'll give you the link because this is way too much to read right now. But I also made a framework for having high expectations. So I was thinking about, like, what would it be like to have high expectations for your student? You know, they're high standards, you know, they're based on standards, the standards are communicated to students, they're inclusive, they're rigorous, and they're broken into milestones, they're scaffolded. Again, way too much to put on one page, but I'm gonna give you the download link for that. And I would love to know what you think about it and how you might apply this in articulating some of your expectations and just kind of figuring out what are our opportunities for improvement based on what we've going on in my school. So the link is on the screen here. I'm going to put this in the chat so that it's clickable, and we will upload some stuff to the Huddle afterward. But let me know what you think. What would you apply this to? What reactions do you have? And I know we've got just 1 minute left, but if you could just leave us at least one message in the chat, that would be greatly appreciated and would help, I think, consolidate everyone's learning. So I'll put this in the chat. You put your reactions in the chat. Heather, final word?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to chat about this. And we would look forward to, if you are interested in this and you want to walk through some examples or interested in sharing some of your work with us, our email addresses are there and we'd be happy to talk that through with you. So please reach out if you would like to.
Yeah, Carlos says, speaking the same language is key. Starting from scratch, Jen, good deal. Yeah, anybody, if you want to chat about this, like we're actively working on the book right now and looking for examples, so happy to chat. Feel free to shoot me an email. Thank you, Peggy. Great to hear from you. Victoria says, clarity and diving deeper with specificity with professional decision making. Good deal. So yeah, and if you want to chat about scope, like a big part of success with this is biting off the right size piece. So we're happy to help. You know, kind of steer you to the right size chunk to take on with something like this. Thank you, Sean. I appreciate you putting yourself out there and being willing to to share a specific example and speak to that. Love it. All right, Kyle, we've got to hand it back over to you in the interest of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Recording stopped.
Yes. Thank you so much, Justin and Heather, for a very engagement and informative breakout session. Like they said, if you would like to have more information, please go back into the huddle. They will be putting some more of the links, information regarding this session. Also, this recording will be put into the huddle as well. If not today, later on today, so y'all can refer back to this as well. And make sure you go check out the Principal Center and also subscribe to Principal Radio too as well for podcast to hear some awesome great things. So once again, I want to thank you all for attending this breakout session and thank you all to our presenters. And without that, I'll close it out.
All right. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks everybody. Bye-bye. Thanks, Justin. Bye-bye.